Hi guys, I am still home. It's awesome to still be home. I was home last week as well when I came from here. And last week, I think I was probably still somewhat recovering. This did take a lot longer than normal to get over not just the whole thing of, you know, traveling sort of 30 plus hours to get home, but also the 6 weeks of events and things. And honestly, this has probably taken me longer than ever to get back to normal in terms of sleep patterns and things. But I am good now. And today was a Friday. So Friday, I get up early and go, and well, I get up early every day, but I go out early and play tennis with my son as well. So we're out there at sort of by 7 o'clock on the court, which was beautiful. It was the coldest day of the year here. We got down to 8 Celsius, which is a record so far for 2017. Look, it feels cold to us, okay? Because you're acclimatized, you get used to things. So that was a pretty sort of chilly start, but very, very nice day because it always kind of warms up, right? And it'll be 20-something today. Next week, we're into 24, 25 by the look of it as well, which is nice for winter. Very nice. Anyway, I don't think you really want to hear too much about the weather, so I'm going to move on past that. And I want to talk about something which is a bit of, I guess, for want of a better term, housekeeping. One of the things that I am... I don't want to say struggling with, but finding the right balance with, is that I get a huge number of emails. Not just emails, but DMs on Twitter, connections on Skype, requests on LinkedIn, like just all over the place. And this is a nice problem to have insofar as it's a reflection of gaining traction with the stuff that people want to read. You know, I put a lot of stuff out there. People are interested in it. They want to talk to me. Fantastic. Happy with that. The challenge is I can't reply to everything. And probably going on about a year ago now, I put a contact page on my blog. And I'm just having a look at it now, and I've got things like my email address, because I do want to be able to give my email address to people to be able to contact me. Obviously, my Twitter, my LinkedIn, like all this sort of stuff, including things like Signal, Keybase, this sort of stuff. But then I sort of go, look, there is kind of three categories of material in terms of whether or not I'm going to get back to you or not. So that there's stuff I'm definitely going to respond to. If it's the media wanting comments on stories and things, well, you know, yeah, I want to put my view on that. If it's people inviting me to events, I'll reply to that. Usually I won't be able to go. I've said no to about 60 events already, more than 60 this year, all around the world, because I just don't have the time. So there's that sort of stuff. And I'll reply if people send me data breaches or stuff that's really important to what I do. I'm definitely going to get back to you. Stuff I may not respond to, and this is where I've, to be honest, just in the last couple of weeks had to move a lot more stuff into, is I get a lot of emails around things like, I'm trying to solve this security problem, or my anti-forgery token doesn't work, or should I use Cloudflare or Let's Encrypt, or, you know, stuff that there's either information out there already, or you can go and ask on the likes of Stack Overflow. The problem is that I just don't have the time to reply to all this and still do the other stuff I do. You know, there was a point where I was getting more and more and more and more and I can handle it, but now I'm kind of well and truly beyond that point. I was getting past it a year ago when I did the contact page. So that sort of stuff I'm not replying to, I just file it away. I know a bunch of people would say, well, you could have like canned replies, which is like, thank you for emailing, sorry I don't have the time or whatever. But frankly, the way that people should be finding my email address is via the contact page anyway, which kind of does say in the first place is the stuff I won't probably reply to. So there's a bunch of stuff falling in that category. I do feel bad about not replying to people that take the time to write to me, but you can see the challenge. Now, I also explain that there's stuff I won't reply to. You can't guest post on my blog. I'm not going to promote your infographic for you. The number of times I get that, come on, get over the infographics. One of the ones that I get a lot lately is it'll be someone saying, hi, we're a security company. We're doing this new thing. It's going to solve all your problems. Would you like to schedule a one-on-one discussion with our CEO or C-something-O? And, you know, you'll get like an insight. It's like, all right, first of all, if he or she wants to speak to me, they can send me an email. I don't like this stuff where it's like, I have delegated a minion to go and send you emails and possibly try and solicit your ear for half an hour or whatever. You know, send it yourself if it's important. People get pissed when you see them delegating stuff out like this. And second of all, it's spam. Like, there are no two ways about it. If you're going, we're launching something, we think you would be interested. I know that you like to say that you think I would be interested. I'm probably not interested. If it is interesting, it will float to the top of the Twitter discussions and the news and everything else, and then I'll probably be interested. But this is not the way to go about that stuff. It's very spammy. And when you then follow up every few days and say, I'd just like to pop this to the top of your inbox, you're making it worse. And there's a very good chance I may get to the point of actually tweeting the whole thread and calling attention to it publicly because it is such a shit experience that makes the web worse. Don't do that. Now, so that's the sort of the emails and things. And there's a lot of DMs I get as well, which I just ultimately have to put in that category of I can't take the mind share away from other things. While we're on this subject, related subject, another one here that I thought I'd touch on is comments on my blog and banning people. Very, very occasionally, I will ban someone from commenting on my blog. And when I say occasionally, this is probably something that happens maybe once every 3 or 4 months. It's very rare. Now, I did it yesterday. I'm going to explain why. I did it. I know I did one just before I went away. So we are going back at least 2 months ago, probably closer to three. It is exceptional. Now, here's why. I want to explain the context. And I do actually have a page on my blog about what's reasonable in terms of comments. Comments on the blog, on any blog, are awesome. They're a fantastic way of people adding to the narrative. And I really like the fact that you can go back to most of my blog posts that have gotten traction with people, and there are tens, dozens, sometimes hundreds of comments that have other interesting perspectives. Now, some of them don't agree with me, and that's fine. People articulate why they don't agree with me. Well, it's fine when they do articulate why. Some of them are fantastic in that they add things I hadn't thought of. Others just contribute to the broader narrative about whatever topic it is I've written about. And I know that there are people who don't like having comments at all. They disable comments on their material, and I think they're missing out big time. Now, having said that, I want to keep comments within the bounds of reasonableness. And there's a few things I mean by that. Number one, if you're abusing me and like swearing at me and absolutely losing your mind, that's not cool. Right? So that is normally the thing where if it happens once, I'll leave it there and I'll reply and say, hey, this is not cool. Normally they're abusing me about something, so I'll address that. And very often I'll say, look, if you want to keep commenting here, you got to play nice. And if you're unsure about what playing nice is, here's a link to that thing I wrote about what is acceptable in terms of comments. And it's usually only after they see that and they continue being just abusive or just downright impolite a lot of times. It's like, okay, this is not making this a nice place for other people. You're out. So there's that. The one yesterday was more along the lines of one individual was continually posting over and over and over again the same thing in reply to other people, effectively saying, look, HTTPS shouldn't be used across the board. Now, that's fine. I have no problems with someone having that opinion. Make your comment, share your opinion, and move on. There's no point going and continually debating it with me multiple times over and other people as well, to the point where I get up in the morning and there's a dozen comments from the one bloke effectively saying the same sort of stuff. And this was very tinfoil hat stuff as well. If you go back through the blog and look at the comments and see where most of them come from, or at least see who is the predominant contributor to comments, you'll see what I mean. So that sort of got to the point where over a period of days, I was like, look, this is getting ridiculous, because if someone comes to my blog and reads about HTTPS stuff, then they go down to the comments, they're going to effectively have one shouty person at the table, which is making it hard for everyone else to have a civil conversation. And this is what eventually led to me banning this bloke just yesterday. Now, that's not something I do lightly. Like, honestly, I thought about this for a day. I was like, when do we get to the point where it's like, okay, you're making this worse for everyone and you need to leave the table? And eventually I removed the individual. And again, if you read through, you'll sort of see at least why I thought that was necessary. You may not necessarily agree, but as I've said multiple times before and did in the talk in Oslo, I'm okay with not making everybody happy all the time. Because if I do that, it's frankly just going to be bland and boring. I want to try and make it interesting and engaging and useful for most of the people most of the time. And this was not helping me achieve that objective. All right, so that's a little bit of context. And I wanted to do it in this video where I can sort of convey tone and sentiment and make sure that it wasn't just sort of viewed as some draconian killing free speech kind of attitude. So that was not the intention at all. It was to try and make it a better place for the 99 point something percent of people who want to come and genuinely contribute to the narrative. Okay, so that was that. One more thing, totally unrelated to bits that I've written. I just thought I'd add some context to it. Yesterday, I asked, what do people think the best way to share a 6 gigabyte file is that may be downloaded, say, 10,000 times and not send me broke? And there were loads of suggestions of people who came up and gave me all of these examples of this is how much it costs to host a 6 gigabyte file, which is basically nothing. But hosting is not the problem. Downloading is the problem. Downloading over and over and over again is the problem. And when people were sending me links to things like, you know, put it in Azure Blob Storage, that they kind of missed the bit, which is it's basically about 66 cents to download a 6 gigabyte blob from Blob Storage. And if someone does that 10,000 times over, that's getting pretty pricey. People would point to Backblaze. Now, that was probably the best pricing of everything, but even that could start to get into four-figure sums of money for people to download this thing. People would say OneDrive or Dropbox. They're not really meant for the mass distribution of files. And if you try and do this, there's a very good chance your account gets locked out, as I know, because I have done it and I've had that happen. Now, actually, to be clear, when I say locked out, they remove your ability to share anything. In fact, I had a couple of years there where I couldn't share a link on Dropbox. You know, where you can sort of right-click and go get public link? A couple of years I couldn't do it. And it was only about probably a couple of months ago I wrote back to Dropbox and went, I'm really sorry I did that thing years ago. You know, can I get my ability back to share files? So I'm not going to go into detail about what the file is. It wasn't something I felt was suitable for torrenting as well, for reasons that will become apparent later on. I'll write this up probably in a couple of weeks. No, it's not at someone's database dump that I'm distributing publicly. There is context. I've had a couple of offers from organizations to make this available in the way that I'd like to, and I'm just seeing what I can do with them and which one's the most suitable to host or support this. So I'll come back to that. I just wanted to sort of add that because there are lots of people going, what about all these things where none of them really made sense in terms of the logistics and the commercials of it. All right, so that is a whole bunch of sort of background stuff. Now let's move on to things that I have written, which I think are worth some discussion. And there's two things this week. So one was my Security Sense column. and oh boy, did we get ourselves in the news last week. We being Australia, because our government has decided that there's a lot of nasty stuff that goes on the internet. And they're right. And every government is having this discussion at the moment. You know, they're everything from terrorists to pedophiles doing stuff via encrypted chat. And their concern is that when there's all this encrypted chat going on, it's harder for them to intercept messages. Now, regardless of where you stand in terms of government oversight, that is a fair observation. It's harder for governments to see messages. Also, regardless of where you stand on government oversight, most people would reasonably argue that there are things we want our governments to be able to do. We want them to be able to issue a search warrant and go into a house and steal someone's machines if they're, confiscate someone's machines if they're running a kiddie porn site or something really nasty like that. We want that to happen. The challenge here is that this is where we get into the realm of governments talking about things like WhatsApp, which seems to be the poster child for this particular issue that the government is having. So people using WhatsApp to chat to each other and circumventing any sort of surveillance. And again, regardless of how you feel about encryption, there is no arguing that there's a lot of stuff that happens over these encrypted channels, which is now very difficult for the government to access. There's also a lot of stuff that they should be able to access. The trick is, how do they do it without stuffing it up for the rest of us? Because we're all worried after seeing things like the NSA leaks, courtesy of Snowden. Now, I think, to be honest, a lot of the narrative from the government is more about how do we gain access to content on devices by means that don't involve breaking encryption. Because it's just not going to happen. We're not going to see WhatsApp go, yeah, you know, like here's a private key or, you know, here's a backdoor or something like that. We may see device manufacturers provide other mechanisms of obtaining data that is in storage at one of the ends. Now, I don't really want to get bogged down in that because the sort of the context of what I actually wrote on the blog post was, can we please stop politicians from talking about encryption? The security sense column, not the blog post. Now, the reason why is there are two comments made by our most senior politicians last week which were cringeworthy, and they made news all the way around the world. Now, the first one was by our PM, Malcolm Turnbull, and our Prime Minister was questioned by a journalist, and the journalist sort of said, how do you intend to break effectively the laws of mathematics in order to circumvent encryption? And this is very often the argument from pro-encryption advocates, where they say, look, encryption is just mathematics. You can't sort of weaken or break the math. Anyway, in responding to the journalist who posed this question about the laws of mathematics, our PM says, well, the laws of Australia prevail in Australia. I can assure you of that. The laws of mathematics are very commendable, but the only laws that apply in Australia is the laws of Australia. And it's almost like, where do you begin? Is he going to start arguing about the laws of gravity in a moment? You know, it's like we're sick of all this shit sticking to the ground. Laws of Australia now say that gravity doesn't. It is the most nonsensical argument. And I don't think that he's doing what he's doing for bad reasons. And again, there are very good reasons why government wants to be able to look at this sort of stuff. But comments like that just absolutely blow this thing out of proportion. And then it was made even worse by our Attorney General. And he was having a chat again with journalists. And now, this bloke, George Brandis, has got a bit of a record in terms of the way he explains technology things. There's a now infamous video of where he's trying to explain metadata a couple of years ago. And it was just a train wreck of fumbling and stumbling and just not having the first idea. So anyway, we get on into George, and George has said, and I'm reading this from my notes here, last Wednesday I met with the chief cryptographer at GCHQ, so this is British intelligence, and he assured me that this was feasible. Now, this was in relation to breaking encryption on WhatsApp. Now, this is almost certainly not what happened. And then we've had some previous chief of GCHQ come back out and be very, very supportive of encryption in the likes of WhatsApp. So to suggest that the Brits have got some way of breaking the encryption on WhatsApp and that it's entirely feasible is almost certainly rubbish. And I just leave that little bit of doubt in there because you never know 100%. But it just looked so bad on the back of our Prime Minister making the comment about the laws of mathematics and laws of Australia as well. And you're just kind of feeling that, look, maybe they're winning the hearts and souls of the majority, but some of the things they're saying are just really riling up the technology community because they're just so preposterous. It would be really nice if these guys took a little bit of a step back from the techie discussion, spoke about the high-level stuff, and then we got good technical people, and we do have many good technical people in government, to communicate this in a more sort of articulate way. I will actually link to a post, link to the podcast. I was listening to Risky Business today, and Pat was interviewing Alistair McGibbon, our sort of chief cyber security guy in the Oz government. And I can't say I agree with everything that was said there, but he made some much more salient points that were much more relevant to the discussion. And in fact, their position was more, look, the government would like to be able to see these messages. We're going to leave it up to the tech companies to figure out how to do it. I kind of felt that's a little bit like just chucking the ball over the fence and going, it's your problem. You work it out. I don't know how that's going to work out for them, but it was certainly a much more informed narrative than some of the stuff we've seen in the press. So I'll put that in the links as well. Now, onto the big stuff, HTTPS. Now, this blog post, so last week I spoke about how I wrote on life being about to get more difficult for websites without HTTPS, because if you, as of Chrome in October, which I believe is Chrome 62, if you go to a website with a form and you click in the form and you start putting any sort of text in there and it's not loaded over HTTPS, you're going to get the not secure thing up the top. So this means the search box on CNN, for example, will make CNN say not secure. Or the email subscribe box on someone's blog will make the form say not secure. So things are changing rapidly. Now, somewhere off the back of that, an absolute Twitter shit fight broke out among people arguing effectively about EV certs, so extended validation certs. So this is when you get the green address bar, which actually has the name of the company in it. And this argument was going round and round and round and round. And it included a bunch of smart people and people who are either influential in the industry or have a very strong commercial stake in it, such as the CEO of Komodo. And this was one of these things where I would get up in the morning and there'd just be troves and troves of people in the comment and threads on the comment and stuff starting to get very, very heated. And I sort of avoided linking into the stuff that does get, almost sort of gets a little bit defamatory. And to be clear, like I was like, I'm just going to stand back and watch this. I'm not getting involved in this at all. But it was getting very heated. And there are a number of different issues that were coming out of this. And I wanted to write something that kind of consolidated a lot of the observations around HTTPS and associated parties. So that the blog post here is on the perceived value of EV certs, commercial CAs, phishing, and Let's Encrypt. And I want to go through these here and just add a little bit of sort of verbal narrative to the whole thing. And really the sort of the first part of this is around what's changing. And I just mentioned we're getting the forms and the not secure thing and everything. And the premise here is that it's going to force more websites to go HTTPS, which basically everyone, except for the ranty bloke in the comments I mentioned earlier, is very happy about. This is good. Now, part of the reason this is happening now is that it's a good time to force more HTTPS because of the free availability via Let's Encrypt. Of course, there's also Cloudflare. You can go and get it for free, but that's bundled up in reverse proxy services and things too. But as far as just getting certs go, Let's Encrypt is absolutely smashing it out of the park. They have now issued more than 100 million certificates, and they really only kicked this off early last year, very late the year before that. So they have gone massive very, very quickly. And we should all be going, this is fantastic, isn't it wonderful? We're getting more encryption everywhere. But as I say in the blog post, one of the problems is that when you have an organization come along and do not just free certificates, but do them in an automated way where suddenly they become easy and you're not sort of downloading different encrypted file formats and then open SSLing it and manually uploading it and, you know, trying to get this kludge of stuff to work. But when you're automating it to the point where it's a click or a couple of clicks, and then it automatically renews as well. And then it's an open model. So any provider can come along and go, yeah, we're going to add Let's Encrypt support to, say, our web portal so that any customers creating certs on our WordPress hosting can just click a button and get Let's Encrypt. When you do that, it gets a lot of traction. When you issue 100 million certs for free, it starts to beg the question, what's happening to the guys that are selling the certs? And no matter which way you look at it, they're losing a bunch of market share. And in fact, I show figures that talk about Komodo, for example. In January this year, they had 44.2% of the SSL market share. By the way, when I say SSL, I know it's TLS. We use all these terms very interchangeably. 44.2, it's now 40.7. So they've lost a chunk of market share in only about 6 or 7 months' time. Same with Semantic. Now, I use Komodo because they're the number one CA in terms of volume. Same with Semantic, same with GoDaddy. They're all diving. In fact, the best that any of them had done since the start of the year is remained flat. So GoDaddy had 2 months where they remained flat. The rest of the time, they've been falling. And then you look at Identrust, which cross-signs these Let's Encrypt certs, and they've gone from like 18.8 to 28.3% from January through to July this year. So clearly, there is this exodus from the commercial CAs into the free ones. And as you can imagine, they're not real happy about this. Now, the reason why I wanted to start with this context is that it helps explain some of the behavior we're seeing from organizations that have a vested financial interest in selling certificates. So, for example, we saw Komodo try to trademark the Let's Encrypt name. Now, this blew up in the news last year, and it looked terrible for them. Because here you have the largest CA in the world making gazillions of dollars selling certs, and they're going, someone's going to do it for free, let's trademark their name. This looked terrible. And then the CEO justified it by saying, how can you prove it was them who made it up? It being the brand name of Let's Encrypt. And that just made things look even worse. So we have things like that. We have other commercial players selling certificates who are continually writing very disparaging things about Let's Encrypt. And a lot of these disparaging things center around the fact that Let's Encrypt issues a large number of certs to phishing sites. So allegedly about 14,000 plus certs have been identified, I believe, just for PayPal. Now, this is and is not a problem, depending on how you look at it. It is a problem insofar as when there is a phishing site that has a cert on it, and suddenly the phishing site has got a padlock and it's green and it says secure, the confidence level in people that see that phishing site goes up because we've been conditioning people to look for the padlock. So you see the problem here, and this is a genuine problem that we need to think about. So that is an issue. On the other hand, the padlock never meant you're talking to someone legitimate. The padlock always meant you have a secure encrypted connection to someone at the other end, and then it made no assurances about who that person is. So in many ways, even though Let's Encrypt is out there issuing certs to a number of phishing sites, it's kind of what certs are meant to do anyway. It's using them in exactly the way they're meant to work. Now, many issues then sort of, I guess, go off from here. So one of them is, well, if you have extended validation certificates, then, you know, you get extra assurance because you see the company name. We're going to come back to that. Another issue off here is that phishing sites have a number of different ways that we can combat them. And we see this all the time with HTTP phishing sites. So, for example, the hosting of the site can be pulled. We can have these sites submitted to the browser vendors so that when you go there in Google, you get in Chrome, you get a great big red screen. It says phishing site ahead. I often see my ISP block phishing sites. I often see Freedom VPN block phishing sites. The DNS for the site can be pulled. There are all these mechanisms of combating phishing sites that work equally well over HTTPS as via HTTP. So that the premise of there being a certificate doesn't in any way stop us from shutting down the site. It just increases confidence for people who go to that site. Now, part of the narrative here, which is really interesting, is that it's Let's Encrypt that cops all the flak for this. You know, Let's Encrypt, you've issued 14,000 odd PayPal certs. What many people didn't realize is that Komodo has issued a huge number of phishing certificates, or certificates to phishing sites. And I've got a graph in here from Netcraft, which shows that actually up until about March this year, Komodo was issuing more phishing certificates than Let's Encrypt. And then as part of Let's Encrypt's sort of meteoric rise, it's actually overtaken them now. And it looks like as of the moment, we've got maybe 16, 17,000 certificates issued from Komodo, and we've got probably about 22,000 issued from Let's Encrypt. Let's just agree it's lots from both. So that's the first thing to keep in mind. They're both issuing a lot of them. Now, the thing where it gets a little bit, let's admit, it's a little bit funny from here, is that at one point in the discussion, the Komodo CEO, Milai, now apologies also if I have pronounced that name incorrectly, but I'd like to sort of refer to him by name. So Milai's tweeted, you know, here's an example of a phishing site. Look, it's got a padlock. And unfortunately, he didn't realize that it was a phishing site using a Komodo certificate. And this kind of demonstrated the point beautifully. And inevitably what happened, I was watching because I wanted to see how did this unfold. The phishing site actually had the DNS pulled. So it wasn't that Komodo was in there revoking certs, because this is their argument. They say, well, we will actually police this stuff and we will revoke certificates if we're seeing it used nefariously. Before they could even do that, all of the normal defences for how we protect sites, or rather how we protect consumers from phishing sites, kicked in, and DNS got pulled, the site got shut down. So unfortunately, that wasn't the best choice of site for him to choose, but it did demonstrate the point, which is that we have both of these two CAs suffering from the same problem. And as much as Komodo says that they're going to police it, you'll very often find, like in this case, the other defences kick in before their proposed value proposition over and above Let's Encrypt does. Now, even if that wasn't the case, so even if Let's Encrypt pulled things very, or we'll rephrase it, even if Komodo pulled their certs very, very quickly before they could be shut down or before the sites could be shut down via other ways, none of that changes how effective Let's Encrypt certs are. It doesn't change the fact that if you go and get one and you put it on your site and there's a gazillion phishing sites out there also using Let's Encrypt, it doesn't decrease people's confidence in your site because they still just see a padlock. It doesn't reduce browser trust. It doesn't make your site less available. None of this happens. There is just a parallel argument to all of this about what role CA should play in policing phishing sites. So that was important. And I wanted to make sure that was clear, that everyone knew that it's not just Let's Encrypt issuing phishing certificates. Now, this brings us on to extended validation. And I wrote about extended validation late last year because I went and got a cert for Have I Been Pwned? So if you go to Have I Been Pwned now, you'll see across the top it says, Have I Been Pwned? And then in brackets, Troy Hunt. And then in square brackets, AU. And the argument here is that when someone goes to Have I Been Pwned and they see that, they can have a much higher degree of confidence that this is actually Have I Been Pwned. It's not one of the dodgy rip-offs that seem to keep popping up the whole time. In theory, this is good, but the practice just doesn't align with that. And there are multiple reasons why. The first one is, as I show in this blog post, if you have a look at Have I Been Pwned without an EV, and instead just a DV, so this is a domain validation certificate. So all you have to do is prove that you control the domain. You don't have to prove that you're not a bad guy and that you are actually a legitimate company. If you just have the padlock, people will trust it just as much. Almost exclusively just as much. Almost. There are some very, very mild exceptions. And I kind of wanted to illustrate this. And the way I showed it is I took the 10 largest websites in the world, and they all serve DV certs. So Google, YouTube, Facebook, Baidu, Wikipedia, Yahoo, Reddit, Amazon, Tmall, which is in China, and Twitter all serve DV certs. None of them show the name of the organization in the address bar. And it has to beg the question, if EV is so valuable, why do the 10 largest assets in the world not support it? Now, one of the good things that came via comment contribution on the site is that EV certs don't have wildcards. And there are many cases where you want to have wildcards because they've got gazillions of subdomains and things like that. So that may well be part of it. But this is sort of the first thing. You've got all of these top sites not showing EV. And one of the interesting nuances that came out of that is that some people went away and obviously tested a bunch of these. And they said, well, hang on, Twitter does have EV. And they're sending me screen caps. Here's Twitter in the browser with the thing on the top that says, like, literally Twitter Inc. And I'm like, wow, that's really interesting. And what I realized is that there are parts of the world where Twitter does serve EV, and there are parts where it doesn't. Doesn't serve it in Australia, doesn't serve it in Norway either. And they are two places that I spend a lot of time. I also spend a lot of time in the US and the UK where it does show EV, and I had no idea. And the point I'm trying to make here is that if someone like me, who actually thinks about this stuff a lot and pays attention to it and regularly goes to places that do and do not show EV, and I didn't even know, clearly I'm trusting the padlock. When I just see the padlock and the text that says secure, that's enough for me. And I actually put a poll out and I asked people about how they feel about EV certs. And in fact, the question in the poll, once I get down to it here, was, where'd my poll go? I had actually said, look, can you please go and ask like a non-techie significant other, for example, and ask them if their confidence levels change. The exact question was, please ask a non-tech person and answer honestly, do they recognize an EV cert and behave differently to DV only? And I gave three options. Yes, they look for EV. No, just need a padlock. And the third option is, huh, what's a cert? Now, 4% of people said they look for EV. But the most impressive figure was that 59% said they don't even have an idea what a cert is. And this is the challenge, which is simply that people are not conditioned to look for EV. There are very good reasons to have EV. Identity assurance is a really, really good reason. But they just don't work how they are. And much of the debate that got so heated, including with Meli on the tweets, was about that there should be a way of having identity assurance. But it just doesn't work the way it is. Now, there is a much broader, longer-term picture that needs to be discussed, which is, should browsers say secure when there's a DV cert? Because secure is a very misleading word. If you go to a website that's a phishing site and it says secure, that is misleading. I got no arguments about that whatsoever. Conversely, if you go to a site with an EV cert, people don't know they should be looking for it anyway. So you've really got a couple of issues here. You've got one, which is the way the user agent actually renders and displays EV because it mixes it in with the whole rendering and displaying of HTTPS. And the other is you've got the education piece. Because unless people know to look for EV, it's not going to make any difference. I had a long phone call with Scott Helm, my friend I've mentioned many times before, who does the world's best TLS training, amongst many other things. So last night, we were having a chat about this. And we're saying, look, unless you sort of get to the point where, let's say hypothetically, the browsers will take the world's largest websites and they will either pin the certs or they will expect EV and they will render the logo into some other place in the browser Chrome, not as part of the address bar on the padlock. And then we trained everyone that you must see the PayPal logo up the top right of the screen in the Chrome, not as a bitmap on the page. See where the education's tricky. Unless we sort of get to something like that, I don't think this is going to make any difference. Now, maybe we will in time. I don't know. The bottom line is that it just doesn't really work today. There's that fraction that will work, that fraction that does make a little bit more difference. And by all means, go and get an EV. Go and spend the hundreds of bucks and then go through all the verification process and the manual installation and everything else. Go do that if you think it's going to make a difference. I'm not against that. I'm not against Komodo and everyone else selling these certs. There is work involved in doing the verification and there is value to it. But let's not get carried away and kid ourselves into thinking that they actually make much of a difference because they just don't. And also, let's not get too carried away ranting and raving about how the world should be different and the browser shouldn't say secure and people should recognize it because none of that happens at the moment either. People interested in that, smart people working for the likes of Google, should go and have that discussion and figure out how to make this better. For those of you over here who are actually trying to build applications that people use today and you're trying to figure out what cert to use, read the blog post and have a think about whether it makes sense. All right, so that was a massive topic, and again, it kind of raged and raged and raged. But do go through and read it. I ended up writing at least 6,000 words. It totally wrote off most of my Sunday and most of my Monday, but I just kind of got on a roll. So check that out. That is, I think that's a very, very interesting discussion, and I think we will see stuff change in the future. Last thing, Raygun is sponsoring my blog again this week. I've had those guys on before. This is one of the sponsors where I definitely use their product extensively. I've been using Raygun on Have I Been Pwned for years because they are looking for things like unhandled exceptions. They're logging them all. They're giving me a portal where I can go and see what's gone wrong. So a good example is I occasionally get timeouts. So I might get a timeout in table storage or a timeout on my SQL database. All that gets logged. I can see what are the requests that are causing it. I can get email alerts, get a whole bunch of visibility. A whole bunch of visibility into what's going wrong. And if you're not using some sort of error logging and reporting like this, you're really seriously missing out. So go and check out Raygun. I love what those guys do, and I appreciate them supporting what I do by being up there on the sponsor bar again this week. So that is it for this week. I got no idea what's going to happen over the next week. This is the joy of the industry that we work in here. So thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll have a great weekend.